Welcome to Earth Matters, coming to you live today here on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, Executive Director of Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. Conducted every 4 years, the National Climate Assessment was released last month and provides a summary of the current and future impacts of climate change on the U.S. The bottom line is that the evidence of human-induced climate change continues to strengthen and that impacts are increasing across the country. Climate change is happening now, and it's due to human-induced emissions from burning fossil fuels. And with us today live via telephone to talk about the latest results from the National Climate Assessment, as well as the latest modeling results for climate impacts to the Gila, is Dr. David Gutzler, Professor of Meteorology and Climatology in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at the University of New Mexico. Dr. Gutzler earned degrees from the University of California at Berkeley and MIT. He held research positions in private industry and the federal government before joining the UNM faculty in 1995. That's the University of New Mexico. He served as a lead author for the chapter on detection and attribution of observed climate change for the next assessment report of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was released last September. Welcome, Dr. Gutzler.
Thanks, Allison. It's my pleasure.
Great. So let's start off by giving people some background on what the National Climate Assessment is.
The National Climate Assessment, or NCA as it's known in the trade, is a federally mandated report that comes out a couple of times a decade. The U.S. government convenes a set of climate scientists who survey recent literature and come up with an assessment of what observed and projected climate change is happening and is projected to happen, and what the impacts and potential mitigation strategies could be, focusing domestically on the United States.
So the most recent decade was the nation's and the world's hottest on record, and 2012 was the hottest year on record in the continental U.S., according to the NCA. And what are some of the major findings regarding the implications of climate change coming out of the report?
Well, to a large extent, the NCA that just came out, and for that matter, the international IPCC report that came out last autumn that I was associated with, have confirmed what previous assessments have stated, which is that we can detect climate change happening now. We can, through various modeling and statistical means, make reasonably confident attributions of the climate change that we observe, as you stated, that a lot of what we've seen over the last half century in terms of climate change is associated with increasing greenhouse gases. And based on that kind of attribution, we can use climate models to make estimates of future climate change based on different scenarios for what future greenhouse gas emissions might be.
The news is not very good, is that right, in terms of where we are, what we've already seen? We've seen hurricanes, we've seen increased frequency of tornadoes, flooding. What's the current situation in terms of the finding that climate change impacts are here with us, we're experiencing them now?
That is the assessment. Now, I wear different hats depending on the kind of activity I'm involved in. And if I put on my pure scientist hat, then I deliberately avoid terms like good or bad, and we just state what is and what's likely to happen. What we see happening is temperatures on multi-decadal timescales getting warmer, which is entirely consistent with what you would expect, given increasing greenhouse gases. There's a huge amount of natural variability from month to month and year to year, and we can talk about that some more during this program, I hope. And so we simply see that happening, and we can try to find associated trends in climate that go along with warmer temperatures here in the Southwest. That would include drier conditions for forests and soils, impacts on stream flow. We see ecotones, that is, changes between vegetation types moving northward as the climate warms up. All these things we see in the data, and we can then use models to project how that might change in the future.
Right, and you mentioned here in the Southwest, and we all know that temperature and rainfall have influenced our landscape and obviously our cultural history and our modern economy, for instance, agriculture. And what is the latest information on projected impacts for climate change on our region here in the Southwest, but it maybe even here in New Mexico?
Sure. One of the things we've learned a lot about in the last decade is not just what is likely to happen in the future, but our ability to look backward in time and figure out what the climate variability has been in the past has tremendously improved. So a lot of research has been done over the last 10 or 15 years in improving the tree ring reconstruction of past climates. So at the same time, we have more confidence and more appreciation for the recent climate change we've seen over the past half century or so, and how that impacts what we expect to see in the 21st century. We've also tremendously increased our appreciation for how incredibly variable the climate has been in the past without any kind of large-scale human intervention. The tree ring reconstruction suggests that there have been tremendous decadal or 30, 40-year droughts, lots and lots of variability that has had a significant impact on prior human civilizations that have been here, societies that have lived here in the past in this part of the world, on the ecosystem that has been around in the Southwest. And so we have a new appreciation for putting observed and projected climate change into context with tremendous variability that we've seen over the past 1,000 or 2,000 years.
Yes, and you were part of state efforts, I believe, under Governor Richardson, the Climate Change Governors Task Force. And I'm wondering if there are similar efforts going on right now to look at climate change, projected climate change, but also, these periods of long-term drought from the past and sort of, where we're headed in the future, especially, there's lots of discussion around the state and especially here in southwestern New Mexico on water, water supplies. And I'm wondering if some of the results coming out of the National Climate Assessment are being used here in New Mexico to inform our decision-making processes.
That is the purpose of the National Climate Assessment, is just to provide some background information. The NCA and the International IPCC reports are both policy neutral, which is to say they very deliberately do not prescribe what sorts of policies are best for nations or the international community to follow. Instead, the purpose is to lay out options. So what we ought to be using the NCA to do is to help guide planning for future water resource management, future energy policy, and so forth. There's some of that going on. There tends to be a bit of a mismatch at times between what the scientific community provides and what policymakers would find most useful. And what a big example of that is that we often in the climate community focus on years like 2080 and 2100. And one of the things I've learned over the years is that policymakers, for better or worse, have a hard time grasping century-scale climate change. Our political system isn't very good at thinking that far ahead. And so there's much more emphasis on the policymaking community on what a climatologist would consider to be rather short-term change over the next 10, 20, 30 years, whereas the long-term climate change community is often looking at 50 to 80 years out.
Right. And so is New Mexico sort of, I'm thinking of the state water plan and all the updates to the regional water plans throughout New Mexico, or it seems like we're still taking a 5 to 10 year perspective on these water issues, and especially in the context of climate change.
That's correct. The state water plan that is in the works does not explicitly deal with long-term planning, really. It's a much more focused on what, to my perspective, is a short-term view over the next decade or 20 years or so. So what I hear from folks in Santa Fe is that they're more interested in planning out to, say, 2050, which is a long-term perspective from a state government, from the state government view, but is pretty short-term with regard to the major effects of climate change.
Right. So let's maybe take a short break here and continue our discussion about the National Climate Assessment. And I think we're going to get into some of the details regarding the modeling, because I think that's really important for people to get a handle on. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, your host for today's program, and I'm joined by phone this morning with Dr. David Gutzler, Professor of Meteorology and Climatology in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at the University of New Mexico. And we've been talking about the National Climate Assessment, and Dr. Gutzler, you are a climate modeler, and so you know a lot about these models that get used to project climate change. And I'm wondering, there are lots of different models and scenarios that have been used by the NCA and to look at impacts to various sectors of our economy and even regions of the United States. And maybe you can give us a sense of how these models work and, you know, how certain are they? How I think that's something that is hard for people to grasp, the uncertainty of these models and how you deal with that certainty.
Well, a climate model is a gigantic piece of computer code that contains equations that are designed to represent the workings of the atmosphere and the ocean and the land surface and the cryosphere, the ice caps and snowfields. All linked together and designed to march forward in simulated time to simulate what is happening outside the window. So the essential physical equations that go into the model are reasonably well understood at large scales. So the atmospheric part of a climate model is very similar to the kind of model that the National Weather Service uses to make a forecast for the weather every day. And based on the success of those models, we know that the models are very good in some aspects and have uncertainties in other aspects that are familiar to everybody because we all are accustomed to weather forecasts. So the forecast for temperature on a large scale, you know, say all of southwest New Mexico, is very well simulated by these models. The basic winds and large-scale circulations, the jet streams and so forth, are very well simulated by these models. Clouds and precipitation are less finely resolved, and so there's more uncertainty in those aspects of the simulation, just like there's more uncertainty in a precipitation part of your weather forecast than there is in the temperature part. A climate model then has the additional complexity that it's coupled to a model that simulates ocean circulations that is just as complex as the atmospheric model. So for a daily weather forecast, you don't really care so much about how ocean currents change. They're going to look a lot like they do today over the next week or so, the duration of a weather forecast. So we don't have to mess around with an ocean model for a weather forecast. But in order to get the climate right, you have to include changes in ocean currents that are affected by the winds and the atmosphere, and the winds and the atmosphere are affected by the ocean temperatures, and it's all linked. And furthermore, we care a lot about changes in land surface conditions, whether the land is getting drier or wetter, because that affects evaporation, which affects the clouds, and everything is linked. These climate models have been around in a pretty sophisticated form for two or three decades. And so as time goes on, we get better and better at using them and figuring out what they do well and what they don't do very well. There's a lot of improvement that goes on. The resolution of the model, that is to say the time and space scales that the models resolve in their equations, keeps getting better and better. So the models are marvelously complex, but in many aspects are reasonably well understood, and their limitations are also reasonably well understood. Those principally in the atmospheric part have to do with clouds and precipitation. Which is not to say that the precipitation and clouds are terrible. It's just that the uncertainty is greater for the hydrologic parts of the model simulations.
And is there some sort of calibration of these models or ground truthing? How can you tell that these models are doing a good job in their predictions or projections?
Well, there's a huge effort that goes into trying to validate the models. Unlike a weather forecast, where we can validate the predictive value of a model by actually making a forecast and see whether it works or not, it's harder to do that with a climate model because the projection that we're making might be 5 or 10 or 100 years into the future, and we can't wait that long to see if it works. So we have to do our validation with what we call hindcasts, looking backward. So can you simulate the climatic variability that we've observed over the 20th century, say, the period of time when we have pretty good instrumental records? And on that basis, climate models generally do pretty well. As time goes on and the models get better and our ability to validate the models gets better and we just do more and more research on the models, our confidence that the models are getting something pretty close to the right answer for the right reasons goes up. And so confidence in modeling has increased quite a bit over the past 10 years.
Right, and you or the climate modelers are looking at various emission scenarios. So, increasing emissions in the future versus emission reduction scenarios. And I'm just wondering, what are the models telling us about the emission reductions necessary to avoid the most dire consequences of climate change? I think we've been talking about 2 degrees Celsius is still probably not good, but maybe we can adapt. 3 degrees Celsius is pretty bad. What are the models telling us about these temperature changes?
I'm going to break your question down into a couple of parts.
Okay, that's great.
First, let's talk about emissions and why that matters. So using climate models that seem to do a pretty good job simulating temperature variability across the globe, we get storm tracks in the right place, we get precipitation varying at roughly the right magnitude, and so jet streams are in the right place and so forth. So if we take a model that we have some confidence in as getting the right answer for the right reason, One of the powerful things we can do with models is to run controlled experiments in a way you can't do with nature. So we can ask a question that you can't ask with observations, which is, what would the climate be like if the sun got brighter? What would the climate be like if we had a big string of volcanic eruptions? What would the climate be like if greenhouse gases stayed the same as opposed to increasing tremendously over the 20th century? And so a big part of our attribution question is, you know, what has caused the observed increase in climate over the 20th century, which is about 1 degree Celsius of warming over the 20th century, and a lot more than that over the Southwest. And the reason we think that greenhouse gases are responsible for the observed climate change is that the models only get the right answer for the 20th century if you put in the effects of increasing greenhouse gases. In other words, we can make the climate, we can make the sun vary the way we think it has over the 20th century. We can do all the things to the climate system that were observed in the 20th century except for the perturbations to the climate that we think people have caused, both in terms of adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere and adding air pollution, particulate air pollution. And if we add all those things, both the natural variability and what people have done, then the models, in general, get something close to the observed variations of climate in the 20th century. If you leave out the greenhouse gases, you don't get the right answer. And at its heart, that's at the core of our ability to attribute climate change to greenhouse gases, because our models that in which we're confident only get the right answer if we include that part of the forcing. So, if that's true, then we can use the models to do controlled experiments on future climates. We can project changes in the sun, we can project changes in volcanic eruptions, we can project changes in greenhouse gases. Of course, we don't know what observed greenhouse gases will be like over the course of the 21st century, but we can make, we can create what we call scenarios, which are different greenhouse gas paths. We could have a lot more greenhouse gases if we continue to burn fossil fuels. We can have a flat line almost if we very aggressively move away from fossil fuels. And without making a recommendation one way or another, as climate scientists, we can simply go through a what-if kind of approach and see what the effects of different greenhouse gas paths would be, keeping in mind that we only get the right answer for the previous century if we put in the observed increase in greenhouse gases. Based on that kind of projection effort, we see a lot of different things that come out, but basically if you want to keep a projected temperature change down to 2 degrees or less, we would have to limit the total amount of greenhouse gas emissions to keep CO2 levels at about double the pre-industrial value. So in the 18th century, CO2 levels were at about 275 parts per million. We're now up over 400. If we limit the increase to about 550 or so parts per million, then we might end up with an overall 2 degree increase, roughly speaking, globally. And that has been rather arbitrarily set as kind of an upper limit for manageable climate change. But that involves a pretty aggressive move toward limiting greenhouse gas emissions, which I think we're going to talk about a little bit later.
Right.
So that's the way we use the models. Okay. So it's the models allow us to do controlled experiments, which is what scientists are in the business of doing. You know, nobody's going to allow us to tweak global greenhouse gas emissions in the real world just to carry out scientific experiments. But we can do that in a model. And so as long as the model is well validated and as long as we recognize the limitations of the model, it's an incredibly powerful tool to look either backwards or forwards in time.
Right, and based on some of the reductions that have occurred recently. What are the trends telling us? It looks like we in the United States have brought our emissions down a bit, but there are also a lot of emissions globally, and of course the global economy is driving those emissions, and kind of where are we? What are the trends telling us? Are we on a good track? Or I know I'm not supposed to use good, bad, but
what's... Oh, you can, but I will refrain from doing so.
Okay. So are we, how are we trending? How are we tracking towards the future in terms of the 2 degrees Celsius versus 3 degrees Celsius? Possible consequence or outcome?
Well, recent trends in greenhouse gas emissions are all up. So there's been no trend at all toward any kind of global reduction in emissions. And as you just pointed out, recent trends are really entirely driven by increased energy usage, which has led to very rapid economic growth in the developing world. So China and India, principally, are the two really big economies that are heavily dependent on fossil fuels and are driving the global trends in emissions. So any kind of international agreement on limiting emissions, such as the Kyoto Protocol that was negotiated late in the 20th century, those efforts have failed completely.
Not good news. And we did hear, I believe it was last week, that the Obama administration released a new EPA limit on greenhouse gas emissions from power plants, excuse me. And I'm wondering what the impacts will be of this new regulation. The little bit of reading I've done, apparently there's been some change in baseline. I guess EPA is using a 2005 baseline versus a 1990 baseline from which they're calculating these emission reductions. And I'm just wondering, what does that really mean in terms of overall reductions? Is the goalpost kind of changing, or what's this new regulation going to do for us?
On a national level, my sense is that the new regulations will provide a nudge toward emissions reductions. It is definitely true that what matters for global climate is global greenhouse gas emissions. And so CO2 and the other greenhouse gases, such as methane, tend to be very well mixed. They last a long time in the atmosphere. And so to a first approximation, greenhouse gas emissions that take place in the U.S. or Argentina or China or anywhere else all have roughly the same long-term global effect. So ultimately, any kind of greenhouse gas emissions program has to be international. But we've been stuck for decades now in trying to figure out how to craft any kind of international mitigation program that's meaningful and that works. The developing world points fingers at the U.S. and Europe and says, well, most of the emissions that have taken place over the past few centuries have come from our part of the world, and so we ought to take the first step and go first in terms of reducing emissions. And Europe and the U.S. in particular, has been very aggressive in pointing back and saying that current emissions trends are being driven by China and India, so it makes no sense for the U.S. to take the first step and without some meaningful emissions reduction commitments by the developing world. And that has been has created a total policy impasse that persists to this day. Mm-hmm. So I'm a humble climate scientist. Do I have the answer for how to cut through that? And the clear answer is no, but that's where we're at.
Okay, so we'll be right back after this short break. Stay with us as we continue our conversation with Dr. David Gutzler here on Earth Matters on Gila Members Community Radio 89.1 FM. Welcome back to Earth Matters. This is Allison Civic of Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. And I'm joined by phone live here in the GMCR studio by Dr. David Gutzler, Professor of Meteorology and Climatology with the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at the University of New Mexico. And we've been talking about the latest climate change information from the National Climate Assessment. And as our region gets hotter and drier here in the Southwest, what are some of the challenges, Dr. Gutzler, that we'll need to address in the future?
Well, the NCA has projected, not surprisingly, that we ought to expect a continuation of some version of what we've seen over the past several decades. That is to say, the region has we've observed a couple of degrees of warming, a couple of degrees Fahrenheit over the past few decades, a couple of degrees Celsius over the entire 20th century. And we ought to expect future long-term warming into the 21st century. Let me quickly interject that those numbers are a lot bigger than any of the global numbers that get quoted, and there's a good reason for that. We expect as climate changes and gets either hotter or colder that those temperature changes should be tremendously enhanced over continents. So continents respond much more rapidly to changes in sunlight or the greenhouse effect compared to oceans. It takes a huge amount of energy to raise or lower the temperature of the upper ocean. And so when we hear numbers like 2 degrees global warming, you can approximately double that for what we ought to expect to see here in the middle of the continent in the Southwest. So a 2 degrees Celsius warming that is often presented as kind of an upper limit for manageable climate change translates into a 4C warming. That's more like 7 degrees Fahrenheit. Here in the Southwest, that's a lot of warming, right? So the projected effects of future climate change here in the Southwest are huge compared to any kind of discussion that you hear based on global temperature change.
And I should just ask you as a reference for folks, the 4 degrees Celsius or 7 degrees Fahrenheit increase in temperature. What's the metric that is that like a mean or median peak temperature or I mean how does that work? What's the baseline from which you judge that temperature increase?
Yeah, that's a great question. In work we've done here at UNM, we've used the entire 20th century as a baseline. And asked for a rate of temperature change above and beyond that. So using a mid-range scenario for future greenhouse gas emissions that does not really include a lot of mitigation of emissions, but some, we calculated an estimate of about 7 degrees Fahrenheit per century warming. So when we talk about an increase of 2 degrees or 4 degrees or whatever, you have to establish a baseline. But the basic rate of warming under that mid-range scenario was about 7 degrees per century. So if we're looking 30 years out, it's, 3/10 of that. If you're looking a full century out, it's all the whole 7 degrees.
Okay.
What that does, that rate of warming would bring us outside the range of known historical climate variability over the past millennium by mid-century sometime, 2050, 2060, something like that.
So does that mean that say, you know, I don't know what the number is, but the highest temperature on record you could add whatever 7 degrees Fahrenheit to that peak, or how really does that work? Is that what we're talking about here? You're looking at peak temperatures?
The number I just quoted was based on monthly average temperatures.
Okay.
And so, to a first approximation, you can take the observed distribution of temperatures from coldest to highest, that includes all the variability from month to month and year to year, and just shift that distribution toward warmer temperatures. If we're looking into the details, there's some suggestion that maybe variability might go up, in which case the warmest temperatures would increase by even a little bit more than the average increase. But that's a secondary effect. I think, to a first approximation, if we say 7 degrees per century, just shift everything warmer by 7 degrees.
Okay, so the whole entire distribution of, say, daily temperature just shifts up 7 degrees Fahrenheit.
Right, and then I'm simplifying a bit, but that's a useful simplification that maybe makes it easier to grasp. Now, to keep in mind that in the observed climate, the interannual variability, which is big in the Southwest, but it's a lot bigger in the winter than it is in the summer, right? So a 5 degree or a 7 degree Fahrenheit increase in winter temperatures is still within the year-to-year variability of winter temperatures. So what that means is that even if you shift the whole distribution up by 5 degrees or 7 degrees, then even in that climate, you can have what would, in a new climate, be a cold winter that would look kind of similar to what we now think of as a very warm winter. But because the variability of the summer is a lot less, if you shift the whole distribution up by 7 degrees, then even the coldest average summers that you would experience in New Mexico would be warmer than anything we've experienced in the historical record. You're totally outside the envelope of historical variability.
Wow, that's amazing. So a question really about what do we do with this information? And over the past few years, we've really seen a shift in the national and international discussions away from trying to reduce future climate changes by reducing greenhouse gases to more emphasis on how do we adapt to these climate change impacts. But, you know, it just seems to me that you really can't forgo one for the other, because it seems like you really need both. And I'm just wondering, you're part of these discussions. What do we do? Mitigation, adaptation, hybrid of those two?
Well, what I've perceived over the past 5 or 10 years is increasing recognition outside the scientific community that the observed climate change we're seeing is real, and that political debate is generally over. It's just gets harder and harder and harder as the years go by to ignore what we see in the data. And because of that, the immediate consequence of that is to focus attention on what do we do, either locally or internationally, to adapt to what is clearly a climate that's already changing. And so some measure of adaptation is now required, whether we plan for it or not, because the climate is changing, whether we like it or not. So some emphasis on adaptation, I think, is necessary, simply because we acknowledge that what we see in the data is a changing climate. Because the mitigation attempt internationally has simply gone nowhere, and people are still talking about it, but nothing effective has been implemented, I think we do see some more emphasis on adaptation because that can't be avoided. So for better or worse, there is some emphasis on adaptation now simply because that's an acknowledgement of reality.
Right. I guess what is scary to me is just giving up on the whole mitigation aspect and just say, okay, there's nothing we can do about it. Let's just figure out how we're going to adapt. But, you know, without really, you know, trying to get global action on greenhouse gas reductions, it just seems like we can't give up on that effort.
Well, I don't... My own personal opinion is that there has not been an abandonment of efforts. We simply don't know how to do it yet, politically. And so not being a politician, you know, I don't know what it would take to get through that impasse. Clearly, if there were technology breakthroughs in energy such that implementation of renewables was truly cost effective with implementation of greenhouse gas emitting sources of fuels, then I think things would take care of themselves very quickly. So we are moving in that direction, but it just hasn't gone very far yet.
Right. Well, I think you're right. It's the political situation that's really, and the potential economic impacts that probably are creating the bottleneck. Let's just take a short break here and come back and talk about climate change impacts here in the Gila region and on the Gila River. Stay with us. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic of Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. And I'm joined today via phone by Dr. David Gutzler, Professor of Meteorology and Climatology with the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at UNM. And we've been talking about the latest results from the National Climate Assessment. And Dr. Gutzler, I'd like to shift gears and talk about your work related to climate impacts on the Gila River. Consideration of the impacts of climate change on Gila River flows is, in my opinion, fundamental to understanding if a proposed Gila River diversion project could work under the Arizona Water Settlements Act. So number one, from a yield perspective, will there be sufficient water in the Gila River to divert? And will increased evaporation from climate change reduce the project's yield? And then number two, is the project feasible from an ecological perspective? So considering climate impacts in conjunction with a diversion, you know, would this cause irreparable harm to the Gila's ecology? And you have completed a report for the New Mexico Interstate Stream Commission on projected climate change impacts to stream flows on the Gila. And I'm just wondering if you can give us a sense of your findings and sort of, you know, how you came about figuring out what the determinants are to stream flow impacts on the Gila.
Sure. Well, the Gila River is... I think the southernmost snow-fed river system in North America, which makes it both a fascinating place to study observed and projected climate change, and also potentially makes it quite vulnerable to the effects of increasing temperature on snowpack. The Interstate Stream Commission asked me to look at observed and projected effects of stream flow on the Gila as part of its very prolonged assessment of the proposed water diversion on the Gila as part of the Arizona Water Settlements Act, as you said. What we see in the data from gauges on the Gila River is that there's just been tremendous interannual variability and long and decadal variability of flows. Those are actually reasonably well understood in terms of shifting storm tracks. So we know that the average position of storms coming in the winter off the Pacific Ocean moves north and south as ocean temperatures change due to natural variability in the Pacific. So, there's been quite a bit of publicity. I think a lot of people are pretty familiar with the effects of El Nino and La Nina and that kind of oceanic phenomenon changing the amount of snowpack that we get here in the Southwest. And because of those fluctuations, the Gila has undergone big fluctuations, like plus or minus 30% over multi-decadal time periods where we have low flows for associated with extended droughts. We have higher flows when the ocean temperatures change and shift the storm track southward. And any kind of climate change effect that we try to project needs to be put into context with those big variations in flow. So over the course of the 20th century, even as temperatures rose over the Southwest, we see no general obvious trend in flow over the course of a century, in most Southwestern rivers, including the Gila. But if we drill into that data a little bit more deeply, what you see is that we went through a very low flow period in the middle of the 20th century associated with the 1950s drought, where precipitation decreased a lot for a decade or more. Then Pacific Ocean temperatures changed naturally, we think, and we went through a wet period in the late part of the 20th century, from the late 70s to almost the turn of the 21st century. I think that's a natural fluctuation, and that what we've seen for the past decade since the turn of the century is another natural fluctuation back toward drier conditions that continue today, right? The Gila's in a real low flow state yet again this year. So the fact that there's been no trend over in total flow over the 20th century, I think reflects some natural variability. But the effect of that increasing temperature that has gone on through both dry and wet periods on the Gila means that the amount of flow coming down the river per unit precipitation is decreasing. So for every inch of rain or snow that falls in the headwaters region, we're getting less flow downstream at say the Gila Gauge or flowing across the state line into Arizona. And that's what you expect to see based on higher temperatures. Evaporation rates go up, snowpack melts earlier, and you get less flow all because of that temperature effect. And the long-term trend associated with temperature, I think, has largely balanced out what I interpret as a shorter-term decadal increase in precipitation that we saw at the end of the 20th century. And so it makes sense to me that as we move forward and temperature continues to increase, that the effect of temperature in decreasing the flow in the upper Gila is going to slowly start to get bigger and bigger and will start to overwhelm the decadal ups and downs that we see due to natural variability. So I do project that flows on the Gila will decrease as projected temperature continues to increase in the 21st century.
And I think you calculated something like 8% off, 8% decrease in stream flow, but from the driest period of record. Is that correct?
That's not quite right.
Not quite right.
Deliberately chose the entire second half of the 20th century as my baseline period. So this gets back to our earlier question about choosing baselines. So if you pick the period between 1951 all the way to the end of the century, then you get both the 50s drought and the wet period that followed that at the end of the century. So I tried to average out the effects of these decadal fluctuations by choosing a very long baseline period.
Okay, so it's 8% reduction off of that baseline that captures that decadal variability.
That was what I tried to do. That's correct. And it's important to note that that 8%, which has a pretty big uncertainty, quantitative uncertainty attached to it, is a relatively short-term outlook. That's for the period between 2021 and 2050 and does not go out beyond 2050, because that's what the ISC wanted to look at.
Right.
As we've stated, they tend to keep a relatively short-term outlook as what they want to work with, short-term from my perspective as a climatologist.
Right. And you know, the shape of the hydrograph, so the peaks and valleys of flows, stream flows on the Gila, the timing of peak stream flow, and then the shape of the hydrograph across seasons due to the monsoons or snow melt runoff, you've found that this is likely to change. These are likely to change considerably over the next several decades. Can you talk
right.
a little bit more about that?
Well, models project that by the end of the century, this century, if we take a longer-term view, then snowpack in the Gila effectively vanishes. Right? So that doesn't... We'll get snow falling, but it'll be more like Albuquerque, where I live, where snow falls here, but the snowpack itself is real problematic. Sometimes we get snowpack that lingers through the winter, and sometimes we don't. And so that is the sort of climate that's, headed your way. You know, we don't get as much snow here as you get in the headwaters of the Gila. So what, even if precipitation doesn't change much, and that's a less certain kind of projection, but if we assume no change in precipitation, just for the sake of argument, then just the temperature effect in having precipitation fall as rain instead of snow for much of the winter, and even the snow that melts, that falls melts rapidly, that means that projected flows in the Gila actually might get a little bit higher or might not change too much in the core of the winter, because snowfall is falling off the slopes and falling down into the river much more rapidly. So the snowmelt runoff peak that you typically get in March gets much weaker, and such as it is, moves earlier, closer to the winter. That has ecological and hydrological effects too, because it means that the springtime low flow season starts earlier and temperatures are warming up. So you have a much longer period in the spring and early summer compared to the current climate. When flows are low, temperatures are high, and so soils and forests tend to dry out a lot more rapidly in that projected climate, because you've got a longer, dry, warm, low-flow period in the spring.
Yeah, and we only have a couple minutes left, but one of the species in particular that you have done some research on in terms of looking at climate impacts to the Gila trout, which is one of our native fish species. And tell us a little bit more about some of the findings from this research that you did a few years ago.
Yeah, I had a student that took a class from me that wanted to look into Gila trout, and so we took a climate model that was state-of-the-art at the time, about a decade old now, and allowed its projection of temperature in the Gila headwaters. We then downscaled very considerably, and we just took a look at the length of the streams that support Gila trout, which are temperature-limited. So as temperatures rise and the higher temperatures move up the mountainsides, the effective length of streams that support Gila trout in the current climate gets shorter and shorter. And the bottom line there was that by mid-century, in this particular projection, the length of the streams in the watersheds that currently support Gila trout decreased by about 70%. So the lower reaches of those streams attain temperatures that were higher than currently are associated with Gila trout. So they effectively are getting squeezed, moving upstream as the climate gets warmer, such that the amount of habitat they'll have decreases a lot, in just within the a half century or so.
Right, right. I think we're going to be seeing more of this with other species as climate progresses, climate change progresses. Well, that's all we have. That's all the time we have today. And thank you, Dr. David Gutzler, for talking with me about the National Climate Assessment and the implications for climate change. And thanks to our audio engineer, Kyle Johnson.